from the Sky News Centre at 5. Millions of people across the country have fallen silent to mark Armistice Day. Prince Harry led the tributes as he attended a service at the National Memorial Arboretum. Tonight, England and Scotland footballers will defy FIFA and wear poppies for their World Cup qualifier at Wembley. But veteran Bill Power, who was at today's commemorations in Staffordshire, is disappointed other home nations aren't following suit.
It means you're trying to remember those have given it all for us and everything else. I think it's an utter shame that Wales and Northern Ireland are back down. They should say, I'm sorry, it's our way of remembering our fallen, and it doesn't matter what you say or do to us.
A mother whose baby daughter drowned after being left alone in the bath has been jailed for 3 years for manslaughter. Jasmine Gregory told Oxford Crown Court she had been drinking on the morning the 14-month-old died in August 2014 at their home in Grove. Boris Johnson, who previously criticised Donald Trump, says the doom and gloom surrounding his election win needs to stop. The Foreign Secretary says European leaders should embrace the billionaire's presidency. Musicians are quoting their favourite Leonard Cohen lyrics as tributes to the singer, songwriter and poet. He has died aged 82. That's the latest. I'm Victoria Long.
It's Friday. Yes, 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Tony Gosling helping me review this week's news is Tom Baldwin from Bristol's Trade Union and Socialist Coalition. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, the British journalist Vanessa Beely is hot foot from Aleppo, and she's been telling a very different story to Channel 4 News about what's going on there. Millions of our taxpayers' money being spent propping up al-Qaeda terrorists, the so-called al-Nusra rebels, who are holding civilians as human shields. What we're seeing on our TV screens bears little resemblance to what's happening on the ground. Also, another great film this week, which still hasn't been shown on our TV screens, Shadow World, about the global arms trade and how it's corrupted politics right across the planet, with author of the book of the same name, Andrew Feinstein. Also, the religion of war. We look back to the last Republican president, George W. Bush's Iraq victory speech, how hollow those words now seem. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius, wet and windy in the early hours. Highs of 14 Celsius, though, this weekend. Dull with some light rain on sunny on Sunday, light rain tomorrow, sunny on Sunday. Next week, highs of 14 Celsius, sunny spells with intermittent wet and windy weather. It's not so good, is it? Next weekend, that's the 19th and 20th of November, highs of 11 degrees Celsius, fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's Tom Baldwin from the Trade Union and Socialist Coalition, also from Bristol District Anti-Cuts Alliance. Hi, Tom, and welcome to the Politics Show. Tell us about both those organisations. What is the Trade Union and Socialist Coalition?
Well, that's a coalition between groups such as the Socialist Party, which I'm a member of, other socialist organisations, the RMT Trade Union, and you know, a whole number of other campaigners that are involved in that. And really, that was set up to try and give a political voice to working class people. At the time it was set up, the Labour Party weren't offering anything of the sort, only a light version of Toryism.
So are they now, do you think?
Well, I think the Labour Party now is a bit of a hybrid beast. There's obviously the wing around Jeremy Corbyn and the hundreds of thousands of people that have joined that party, you know, looking for a vehicle that is anti-austerity, that's going to challenge for a better future for ordinary people. And then there's the kind of Blairite wing, most of the MPs, a large bulk of the councillors as well, and the party machinery that want to keep that kind of Tory-like policy going.
You can actually apparently be suspended from the Labour Party for tweeting the word Blairite. Martin Summers, why is that?
Well, you better ask those who want to suspend those who treat them.
Would you dare to call someone a Blairite?
Well, it seems to me pretty ridiculous that we can't use what is essentially a neutral term to describe people's politics.
I mean, people who are being accused of being Blairites might say, well, actually, they think that the whole Blair era is in the past.
Well, I mean, there's still, as I understand it, in Bristol, a number of Labour Party members who've been suspended, supposedly for breaking party rules about use of language.
So many, in fact, that they no longer have a majority on the City Council.
Well, indeed, including several councillors. But I must admit, I'm not really au fait with this, where that's got to. It strikes me that everybody's got a little bit overheated about this, and there are bound to be political differences in a big political party like the Labour Party, and, we shouldn't get upset about it. People are going to have different views.
Yeah, and also accusations of anti-Semitism, we'll be hearing about those a bit later on. But back to you, Tom. What about the Bristol District Anti-Cuts Alliance? I mean, this is obviously it's been going for a long time now, probably since 2010, 2011, when the first knives were stuck in of austerity. Who's part of that alliance?
There's a lot of people involved in that. It was set up in 2010. It was activists from the NUT, Union of Teachers, and the Civil Service Union, the PCS, that really launched that. But it's kind of acted as an umbrella group for different anti-cuts campaigns across the city. We've been involved, defending things like home care, defending things like libraries, Protect Our NHS has kind of been born out of that as well. So there's a lot that's been done by that group.
Now, you sort of saying, well, there are interesting wings in the different wings now around Jeremy Corbyn in the Labour Party. Well, where does Marvin Rees sit into all this, our wonderful new Labour mayor?
Well, he's been very coy about who he supported in the last leadership election, whether it was Corbyn or Owen Smith. I think he noticed that the MPs got a bit of a slate in by a lot of the members for their attacks.
Well, isn't that a wise tactic for him to do? Because, I mean, whoever wins, he's going to have to work with them, isn't it?
Well, I think there's some truth in that, but I think, members and people who voted for him, I think, do deserve to know what his position is and what his point of view is. But I think, regardless of what he says, we can see what he's doing in action. Is carrying out Tory austerity. The council is faced with budget cuts from the government, but he is passing that on to the people of Bristol. And some of the things that have come out in the proposals that have come out in the last couple of weeks are quite eye-watering, really. Charging people with dementia more for their care, cutting all the lollipop men and women from the outside the schools.
Well, it would be lovely,
city.
Tom, to get you head-to-head with Marvin, so we'll see if we can do that. I did put a month or so ago in a request for him to come on. I didn't get any reply from the mayor's office, but I'm going to be a little bit more insistent because I would love to hear what he's got to say to this, because we're seeing a decimation of Bristol City Council under Marvin's reign, redundancy of 1 in 6 council staff.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, we met with him, a delegation from the Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance met with Marvin a few weeks ago, and his response really was that his hands are tied, that the cuts are coming from central government and he has no choice. But what we tried to lay out is there are options that he can take. The council has the power to borrow money. It has quite a lot of money in reserve. Those things could only be used on a temporary basis, but they could be used to protect the city's jobs and services, and that would allow the time for the building of a campaign that can push the government back. I think, the cuts that he's outlined in the last couple of weeks, bad as they are, they represent only about a third of the total cuts that he's expected to have to make before his term of office is over. So unless we take a stand now and stand up to the government and demand the money that the city needs, then I think, some council services will not just be stretched, they will completely fall apart.
Martin, doesn't sound good, does it? Sounds like Marvin is simply signing a little chitty for cuts written out by George Ferguson and by the Tory government.
Well, that's because of the political structure of Britain, where the central government determines what local government can do.
Well, just like George Ferguson, it was exactly the same situation.
Yeah, exactly.
But Marvin could be making a big fuss about this. He could be drawing on reserves, this kind of thing, to preserve the council. We all pay council tax.
Well, I think that even
going.
If you were to do that, the likelihood is, I mean, we might have a snap general election, but don't forget there is a parliament bill.
Can we just scotch this for a minute? A snap general election is not going to happen.
No, exactly.
Because the Conservatives would lose.
I was just they wouldn't necessarily lose, but they can't have a snap general election easily because of the Continuity of Parliament Act or whatever it was that they passed. It's actually quite difficult
Tom, come in on that one.
Well, they did. Cameron passed the 5-year fixed Parliament Act, yeah, partly to try and hold together a coalition with the Lib Dems, I think, at the time. I think they could overcome that if they wanted to. And I wouldn't be that surprised if they decide to go for an early general election, particularly if, the Blairite wing of the Labour Party, if I'm allowed to use that word, is still at the throat of Corbyn
at
that time.
I'm not sure Martin's allowed to.
There are deep divisions within the Tory party as well, obviously, but if they see Labour as being more divided than themselves, if they don't see Labour taking back Scotland at that time, may well think that an early general election will kind of secure her a bit more legitimacy and take advantage of the divisions in the Labour Party.
Well, I can remember a situation a little bit similar after Gordon Brown took over from Tony Blair, where there was a possibility he might have called a snap general election, and of course he could have done actually very well on that, he'd just come into office. He's kind of, what do they call it, not a moonlight period, what is it, Martin, come on, you
honeymoon.
Know thing. Honeymoon period, and he, I think, would have done very well. I think if the Tories went to the country now, they'd lose, actually, because
that's not what the opinion polls are saying, Tony.
Really?
Of course not, no. I mean, they're actually 17 points ahead in the opinion polls because of all the nonsense that's been going on with the Blairites and the Labour Party causing all the problems for us. But let's just come back to what can be done. If there isn't an early general election, then the council could use reserves, but those reserves will run out pretty quickly. Yeah, they're not a there's not a huge amount of money there, and then you wouldn't have any reserves, and you would be accused of not being responsible, and so on and so forth. Back in the 1980s, the militant tendency who were in charge of Liverpool decided not to set a rate and not to carry out the cuts, but that of course then bankrupted the council.
But there's a halfway
house, exposed the councillors themselves.
We know that.
To sue it,
but
it didn't work.
There is a halfway house, isn't there, Tom? And I imagine that's actually what you want to see.
Well, I mean, the militant tendency, which Martin mentioned, is now the Socialist Party, which I'm a member of. And, you know, actually what happened in Liverpool prior to the ejection of the council there, the undemocratic removal from power by the Tory government, was that they built more council houses than the rest of the country did put together. They built colleges, they built nurseries, and, you know, stood in stark contrast to the austerity measures that Marvin Rees is putting forward at the moment. And actually some of the powers that the government used against them, such as the surcharge, the suing of the councillors individually, are not available to the government any longer. They've been removed from the statute books. So I think, in a legal sense, his hands are actually freer than, you know, perhaps he thinks they are, and he's more option to fight the cuts. But I think, you know, regardless of the tactic that you use, it can only be a stalling measure, the use of reserves. You know, what's key here and what's needed is to mobilise the people of Bristol, and in fact to link up with the other cities across the country that are in this same position, and to lead a campaign that says enough is enough. You know, we cannot take it any longer. The piling of cuts upon disabled people, people with dementia, some of the most vulnerable in the city are the ones that are really facing the brunt of this. But everybody's going to lose out, and the only way that we can make sure that that doesn't happen is to stand up to the bullying government and refuse to make the cuts that they're demanding.
One of the tools that Marvin could use, apparently, is the Condemn Government's 2011 Localism Act. What do you mean by that? Because you've pointed to this as something which Marvin could be using right now.
Well, the Localism Act spells out that councils have power to do anything that they're not explicitly blocked from doing. So that is a kind of legal framework for a bit of greater power for local councils. But I mean, I believe that is also the act that removed the powers of surcharge from the government. I mean, they are still able potentially to send in civil servants to run the city, but they have to prove that the actions that he's taken have lost the city money. You know, there has to be a legal process that's gone through that proves that he's not fit for office. And, you know, I think he would be hugely popular if he said, oh, I'm standing up, I'm refusing to make these cuts. That would make it very, very hard then for the government to go ahead and to do that.
Well, I'm glad I'm not in Marvin's shoes, frankly, because it's actually a very difficult position to be in. I would like to see him taking a strong line against the government's austerity policy, but I can't see that you can necessarily magic money out of thin air which isn't there. I mean, one of the things you could do, for example, is close the libraries and the facilities in Tory wards, because that would bring the message home to people who vote Tory that if you want to have an austerity policy at central government level, that means your library is going to close, but we're going to keep the library open in a Labour ward. I don't know how that would go down if Marvin was on this programme with us. He'd probably say that that was an extreme measure.
Well, I think, you know, this is a discussion that's it's difficult to have without Marvin here, so I have to re-request that he will come along and speak to us, Tom, and we'll get you back on at that time at some point.
Yeah, I'd be very happy to do that.
And just discuss this all through, because we all pay our council tax. We expect the council to do this work for us, and it's just simply not good enough, I think, for the authorities here in Bristol to just simply say, well, we've just got to do what we're told by Westminster. Otherwise, what's the point of them being there?
That's a good question. Why do we have local elections at all? You could argue that you shouldn't campaign in local elections, and we should just ignore local elections and just try and win national elections, because by participating in local elections, we give credibility to an uncredible setup.
Staying with the cuts, Bristol City Council risks turning Bristol into a rubbish tip with massive increases in waste charges. Bristol could be about to suffer an explosion in rubbish dumped in the streets thanks to a change in City Council charging policy. Opposition councillors say they believe fly tipping is about to spiral out of control because of a 67% increase in the council's charges for getting rid of large items like fridges, sofas and beds. The council's Tory group says the huge rise in charges risks turning Bristol into a tip. With fly tipping set to rise, people decide to dump items instead of paying the new charges, Tom.
Yeah, that's right. I think, you know, what this is an example of really is a bit of the false economy of austerity. The extra charges that they're making to people, and people on benefits who currently get this for free are going to have that discount taken away from them. What this could well lead to, and in fact it's a Tory councillor that's pointing this out in the news report that you've got here, is that it could lead to a large increase in fly tipping. And in the long run, that could not only make the city a less pleasant place to live, but also will increase costs to the council. So, you know, making a cut in one area could lead to an increase in spending in another. And I think, you know, that actually is a point that Marvin Rees himself has made before in relation to other things. But I don't think it's a very good argument for saying that refusing to make these cuts is not recklessness, but actually it's more prudent economically, because it doesn't mean another part of the public sector or another part of the council picking up the bill further on down the line.
Martin, people who are caught can go to jail for 12 months and also be fined up to £50,000. This is for dumping things like fridges and televisions or whatever around the city, rather than paying these exorbitant charges for them to be accepted at the dump. And it's a little bit counterproductive, because people, generally speaking, will pay a reasonable charge at the dump if they're asked to, I don't know, a fiver or something. But if they haven't actually got the money, then they'll just go and dump it. Or if they haven't got a car, they haven't got any transport.
Then if you haven't got any money, they're not going to be fined £50,000.
Well, they will be. It's just
they can't pay it even if they find it.
This is getting a little bit pointless, isn't it? The idea is this is used to dissuade people, a £50,000 fine, from someone who's wealthy who just dumps something in the street. But clearly the reason they're not doing this, or won't be doing this in the future more, is because they just haven't got transport, they haven't got money.
Well, perhaps all of this stuff ought to be picked up for nothing. Maybe Richard Eddy should be pushing for that, but then he'll have to have a word with the Conservative government and say, actually, my policy is we're going to pick this stuff up for nothing. Or maybe we should reduce the charges, and then in Richard Eddy's ward, we'll close his library to make up the money.
Interesting. Richard Eddy is one of the city slackers, by the way. I think when we very first started doing the show back in 2008 or so, he came on once and he just doesn't reply to any of my requests for him to come on.
He was very ill for a long time, if you remember.
Yeah, but he's not now, apparently. And, I mean, if he was very ill, then how can he be a councillor? I mean, you do wonder, don't you? But he's bouncing back. But really, Mr. Eddy, if anyone knows who Mr. Eddy is, Richard Eddy is listening, please do tap him on the shoulder and say, look, go on the radio, Richard, and say this to everybody. What's the problem? Or just please, Richard, just reply to a phone call, you know. Anyway, Also, Bristol street preachers are to appear in court charged with religiously aggravated public order. This is also in the Bristol Post this week. Four American-style preachers who took to the streets of Bristol to spread the word will appear in court. Four men who are yet to be named officially all stand accused of religiously aggravated public order offences. The men arrested in Broadmead in July were due to appear before Bristol Magistrates Court next month, police confirmed. Spokesman for Avon and Somerset Constabulary said, following an investigation, Crown Prosecution Service has authorised the men aged 63, 52, 51 and 50 to be charged with the offence, which falls under the Crime and Disorder Act. Two of the men thought to be from the United States, another is said to be from Bristol and one from Taunton. Crowns complained about the mixture of street preaching and alleged they had been offensive to Muslims, to homosexual and the divorced. Tom.
I hadn't seen this story actually. It's a kind of indication how amongst a number of different religions there is a kind of fringe of people who not only practice their religion but, you know, use it to go on the offensive against other groups. And, you know, I'm sure most people wouldn't support this this having happened, and, you know, it's probably quite right that they've ended up in court if indeed they have done what they're accused of.
Fined and jailed, is that because, I mean, they're basically, this is starting to look like it's an attack on their faith and freedom of speech.
Well, I think, you know, the freedom of religious practice is one thing, and the freedom of speech, you know, I've no problem with them going and preaching in the centre of town, but if that then spills over into, you know, as has been said, them kind of verbally attacking gay people, attacking divorced people, people of other religions, then, you know, that's obviously not tolerant at all. I don't know if prison is necessarily the right outcome for that, but some kind of punishment to try and stop them doing that.
The men were said to be friends, Martin, of the US-based Cross Encounters Ministry, I think they're probably supposed to say, which claims to proclaim the gospel, disciple believers and assist churches to do the same. The brothers apparently are rejoicing and singing hymns in their cells. Are they actually in cells? I do find that a little bit surprising. Anyway, Martin.
Well, I mean, in general, I'm in favour of people being allowed to say whatever they like. But there are rules and laws about incitement to racial hatred and
so
forth.
What about the angry crowd that gathered near them and insisted that they stopped saying what they were saying?
Well, that goes with the crowd has got freedom of speech as well. You've got to expect hecklers if you're going to say stuff. I mean, my instinct in general is to let people say what they like. But then you've got to accept that others are going to say what they like as well.
What about
and
the
that
possibility?
Can become problematic.
What about the possibility that this is a deliberate provocation? Because most people wouldn't object to a preacher in the street.
It's common to find people preaching various versions of Christianity in the centre of Bristol of a Saturday. It's been going on for years. Some shoppers grumble because they're going shopping and they don't necessarily want to be harangued. But on the other hand, people generally put up with it. If they've actually managed to get an angry crowd responding to them, that's because what they're saying has offended people. And those people who are offended also have freedom of speech to say that we're offended.
It's interesting, Tom, isn't it? I mean, homosexuality was only legalised in the 1960s, effectively. I mean, if they'd have been doing that back maybe in the 1950s or early 60s, there probably wouldn't have been a problem. And if anyone was shouting at them, telling them they wouldn't say it, they would be the ones arrested.
Quite possibly, yeah. I mean, it shows that on certain issues we have gone forward as a society, and the fact that people were willing to stand up to them is obviously a good thing. But, you know, it shows, I think, also that we do need to be vigilant, because there are some people that would seek to divide people against one another and do still preach hatred. And I think, you know, as I've said...
I mean, would you put this in the same category as someone like Abu Hamza, you know, the guy who was deported? I mean, this is preaching hatred. It's freedom of speech on one hand, but other people would say this is hatred.
In a sense, yeah. I mean, I don't know the exact nature of what they were saying. I mean, the accusations against Abu Hamza was that he was also, you know, preaching violence and kind of attacks against people that he disagreed with. So I don't know how exactly comparable they are. But, you know, free to offend people possibly, but when it spills over into hate speech and targets specific groups, you know, I think then that does become a problem.
Well, that's certainly something going to be something interesting to check out in court. I'm not quite sure when it's coming into Bristol Crown Court or Magistrates Court. Anyway, 7 months of delay is expected on Bristol's busiest traffic hotspots thanks to the Metro Bus roadworks. More sort of latest update, I suppose, on the traffic nightmare out there. Major roadworks start at the bottom of the M32 to remove the central reservation. Well, it can't really be an M32 anymore if it hasn't got a central reservation, I would imagine. So goodbye, M32.
Well, that bottom part's already a 30-mile-an-hour limit, isn't it? So it's not particularly motorway. If it is where I think it is.
Yeah, and it's supposed to going to be lasting 7 months, this. Work's taking place in readiness for the wonderful, glorious, all-singing, all-dancing, maybe, Metro bus. But at the same time, permanent speed cameras are being installed to enforce new speed limits, 30 miles an hour, folks. The motorway is one of the worst stretches of road in the city for delays and jams. And also can announce that, having had communication with Mark Bradshaw, who does transport of the City Council's cabinet, he's going to come in, fingers crossed, in January to talk about it, explain exactly what's going on with this whole Metro bus thing. But Martin, more and more delays, that's all we seem to be getting.
Well, I mean, we keep coming back to this, don't we? As I've said about Metrobus before, it's a sort of bodge, really.
Yeah.
We're not prepared to... I mean, the obvious thing to do, to my mind, would be to have something like free buses, where people just get on without paying. And there's no reason why you couldn't do that. That's what Ken Livingstone was moving towards in London in the early 80s, when he had his legs broken. But we'll carry on bodging until we get a serious commitment to doing. I mean, we could pick up all the rubbish for nothing as well. Why does anybody charge anything for getting stuff taken away? But you'd have to raise the money from somewhere. Perhaps we should go back to the rates.
No, funny
and
thing is,
make wealthy people pay more.
The funny thing is,
and
it's
then
actually
we'd have all the money to do it.
It's actually cheaper in a lot of ways to do it for nothing, because you haven't got all of the sort of finance.
Absolutely.
For example, getting on a bus,
free is
getting
cheaper.
On a first bus without having to pay is a hell of a lot quicker than even having to get your phone out.
Coming back to what we were saying earlier about collecting rubbish, if it was free, people just phone up and people would come and take it away.
So what was Ken Livingstone planning in London? Because he had his legs broken, effectively. The Great London Council was abolished in the Thatcher years, because this is what he was planning to do.
He was on a
5-year programme during his term of office as Mayor of London to turn London into a free public transport city. Well, free buses anyway. There's a question over whether the underground was going to be free and the trains free. But
he's obviously been moving in that sort of direction, but the House of Lords overruled it and said he's failed in his fiduciary duty, because he's got to run London Transport at a profit, even though London Transport had never been run at a profit, had always been subsidised. But because he increased the subsidy, he was then accused of not fulfilling his fiduciary duties, and the policy was overturned. Dave Wetzel started the so-called Fares Fair, Can't Pay, Won't Pay campaign, which I tried to participate in, where we tried
you were
not
trying to get on the buses
to pay,
without paying. Yeah.
And of course, you then got a whole row going on the bus because you refused
to
pay.
But you could pay.
And so, now, eventually, what I did do, I used to buy a ticket and override on my way home from work, and then plainclothes police were put on the bus to catch me overriding. So they then reported me to the conductor, and then I pretended to pay the conductor, who was a Sikh guy, and then he gave me the change back, which was exactly the money I'd given him, so that the police could not see what we'd done.
We couldn't
sustain it. But in any case, we shouldn't have had to do that. The policy was a perfectly reasonable policy. It's what he'd been elected to do, but the Tory law Lords overruled it and made it impossible for him to do it.
It's worth saying,
if we'd done that in the early 1980s in London and moved towards free public transport in London, just think how different London would be today in 2016.
Yes, they were doing a similar thing in Sheffield as well, weren't they? And Ken Livingstone then wrote a book afterwards. Great read, it's fantastic read, folks. I recommend you can go on bookfinder.com or something. It's called If Politics Changed Anything, They'd Abolish It. Now, Tom, what about here in Bristol with the public transport and the possibility of actually... I mean, the thing is, if it was free, I mean, this is not pie in the sky. This is perfectly reasonable. In some cities around the world, they do have free public transport. That would solve the problem of car congestion almost overnight.
Yeah, I think that would be fantastic. I think the main obstacle to that is the fact that we have a privatised public transport network. So companies like First are running that for a profit, and they're not going to continue to run it if they're not making money out of it. That's, you know, they're not doing it out of the goodness of their
the
hearts.
Well, the money that we pay in fares for First goes back to the United States, because it's an American company that's got massively into debt. So all they're actually doing, when you pay your bus fare, whether it's on your phone or whether it's cash or whatever, is it's just going to the banks in America to service the debt of First Bus.
Yeah, that's right. They've just raised the fares, obviously, for people who aren't using the mobile app. And it's not just the fare money that they get. They also get subsidy currently from the city council, from council taxpayers. So I think if you were to remove companies like that and have the council running the buses themselves, I think that's the basis on which you could make it free, or certainly considerably cheaper, and have that money used only to run the system, not, as you say, to pay dividends out to the shareholders.
Bedford prison riot. Recent inspection found unacceptable conditions. This is conditions in Bedford prison this week, where 200 inmates went on a six-hour rampage last Sunday. Has declined to unacceptable levels. Illegal drugs more readily available than clothes or sheets, the prison inspector said. Martin?
Well, I mean, there's obviously a big crisis going on in the prisons, again, as a result of cuts, less people being banged up for 24 hours a day without proper, recreation and so forth. And, of course, more people ending up in prison. Many people shouldn't be in prison for non-violent offences. So, for example, think of all the people in prison for drugs offences, which are non-violent offences, but they get sent down anyway. They shouldn't be there, and then you're surprised that there's drug use in prisons. It's part of it. The problem with the prison system is it's kind of a Cinderella service. Nobody really wants the prisons to function properly. They don't want to think about them, they don't want to care about them. But in actual fact, in places like Norway, where they have a very liberal prison regime, they've got the lowest reoffending rates in Europe. And in actual fact, that when you fight, it's a last, sending somebody to prison should be a last resort. And you should always attempt to try and reform those that you send, apart from some who just need to be there because they're a danger to others. But we use them as a dumping ground for the mentally ill, for people who are addicted to drugs, people who don't pay their television licences. Loads of people in women's prisons are literally sent there for basically non-violent.
How about for somebody in Broadmead doing what John Wesley used to do hundreds of years ago?
Well, it depends what they're saying. I in principle would say that everybody should be allowed to say whatever they like, but I do know that we do have laws against incitement to racial and religious
hatred. Anyway, Tom,
hatred.
He said, Mr. Gillen from the Prison Officers Association, said, I think there were mobile phones in Bedford prison, which are not allowed. But the same token, prisons are awash with mobile phones and drugs, also, which are not allowed. Initial reports suggest staff there refuse to unlock prisoners on safety grounds but have been overruled by managers. So the staff, it seems, are in touch. The managers are trying to manage the prison like it's a sausage factory and just saying you've just got to do it, whereas they're not listening to the staff who are giving the warning signs.
Well, that would be true of most industries. The staff on the shop floor are the ones that know how it works, and the managers are trying to squeeze as much work out of them for as little money as possible. And that clearly is the case within prisons. I agree with what Martin was saying about, the effects of austerity on this. And prisons won't be able to do what we want them to do. They're not just for punishment. They should be for reform. Positions where there aren't enough staff in order to deal properly with the inmates. They simply get caged up like animals for 24 hours a day, where the only thing that they have to do is take drugs, where those drugs are more available than sheets or clothes, according to this report. That is quite shocking. And that is a system that's on the verge of collapse at the moment. And, Martin is right about the kind of people that are sent to jail. If you commit benefit fraud, you get sent to prison. If you commit tax avoidance, you get a seat in the House of Lords, it seems.
No, you're right. This is a completely skewed system, isn't it? Just let's move away from the UK for a minute, because there's been something going on over in the United States, I believe, this week.
USA! 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 USA!
Thank you.
USA! USA!
Thank you very much, everybody. I'm reaching out to you
for your guidance and your help so that we can work together and unify our great country. As I've said from the beginning, ours was not a campaign, but rather an incredible and great movement made up of millions of hardworking men and women who love their country and want a better, brighter future for themselves and for their family. It's a movement comprised of Americans from all races, religions, backgrounds, and beliefs who want and expect our government to serve the people, and serve the people it will. Working together, we will begin the urgent task of rebuilding our nation and renewing the American dream. I've spent my entire life in business looking at the untapped potential in projects and in people all over the world. That is now what I want to do for our country. Tremendous potential. I've gotten to know our country so well. Tremendous potential. It's going to be a beautiful thing. Every single American will have the opportunity to realize his or her fullest potential. The forgotten men and women of our country will be forgotten no longer. We are going to fix our inner cities and rebuild our highways, bridges, tunnels, airports, schools, hospitals. We're going to rebuild our infrastructure, which will become, by the way, second to none. And we will put millions of our people to work as we rebuild it. We will also finally take care of our great veterans who've been so loyal, and I've gotten to know so many over this 18-month journey. The time I've spent with them during this campaign has been among my greatest honors. Our veterans are incredible people. We will embark upon a project of national growth and renewal. I will harness the creative talents of our people, and we will call upon the best and brightest to leverage their tremendous talent for the benefit of all. It's going to happen. We have a great economic plan. We will double our growth and have the strongest economy anywhere in the world. At the same time, we will get along with all other nations willing to get along with us. We will be. We'll have great relationships. We expect to have great, great relationships. No dream is too big. No challenge is too great. Nothing we want for our future is beyond our reach. America will no longer settle for anything less than the best. We must reclaim our country's destiny and dream big and bold and daring. We have to do that. We're going to dream of things for our country and beautiful things and successful things once again. I want to tell the world community that while we will always put America's interests first, we will deal fairly with everyone, with everyone. All people and all other nations. We will seek common ground, not hostility, partnership, not conflict.
Well, gosh, I'm wiping a tear from my eye as I listen to all of that. I mean, when he mentioned the American dream, it reminded me of something I had read years ago. The American dream, you've got to be asleep to believe in it. Because in actual fact, America isn't really a dream society. It's only a dream in their, it's in their minds that it's such a great place. It's not been a great place for a very long time. What's the meat in what he's saying there? He's going to spend money on infrastructure. That's good. I'll be in favour of that. But I do have the question, how are you going to pay for it? Are you going to carry on running up debt, or are you going to tax the wealthy to pay for it? Are you going to tax yourself, Donald, since you haven't paid any tax in 4 years?
Tom, what do you make of the election? Democracy in action?
Well, I mean, not really. It's a two-party system, which makes it very hard for other voices to get heard. And these were the two most unpopular candidates in American presidential history. But, you know, also she got more votes than he did. It's only via the electoral college system that he was able to win. But I think while this is a bad outcome, then I think it's quite understandable. There, as here, people are angry, they're unhappy with a society that's not delivering for them, and they want change. And what Hillary represented was the status quo. She was the candidate of Wall Street, Walmart and war. And Donald Trump was seen as an outsider. He was talking about jobs, he was talking about infrastructure. Now, he's got no solutions to those things. In fact, you know, I think he will make things worse, will increase the divisions in there. But, you know, I think an important thing to note is that, you know, while this is a bad result, that anger that people are showing hasn't just been represented on the right by the likes of Donald Trump. You also saw ballot initiatives for the raising of the minimum wage go through in a number of states. You saw in the primary campaign the huge support that someone like Bernie Sanders got, putting a very left-wing program across there. So, I mean, America is changing. The status quo can't hold any longer because it doesn't deliver for people. I think the important things for people in America now is to mobilise against Trump and his worst policies, to stand in and defend women, immigrants, LGBT people that will undoubtedly come under attack, not necessarily even by Trump, but by people that are kind of whipped up by this, but also to build a real socialist alternative to this and to the both the Democratic and Republican establishments and not allow this to happen again.
Martin, isn't US politics really just about managing the slow collapse of the economy, you know, from a massive industrial nation to, well, I mean, a totally one of the first countries that's going into the post-industrial world?
It is. It's a very, I mean, and it's a fundamental, I mean, they've got a first past the post system like we've got, which is why you end up with, you know, it's Tweedledum or Tweedledee.
Yeah, but hang on, because the Republican Party, you've now got the President, the Congress, and the Senate.
Yeah, well, then that's really worrying, because Trump has got some kind of alternative views about things like infrastructure and so on, as he mentioned there.
I mean, how much power,
but of course,
the
Republicans in control of Congress and the Senate will tell him what to do.
Okay, and how much power does President Trump going to have?
Well, not very much, really. I mean, if Wall Street crashes, as it may well, on his watch, President Trump will flounder, because he hasn't really got a policy for dealing with a crash. What's he going to do? I mean, they really need to rebuild the tax base. During the Korean War in the 1950s, the top rate of tax in the United States of America was 96%. And it didn't cause a reduction in the money coming in to the government, as some right-wingers seem to believe. It actually increased the resources available to government, which they then spent on infrastructure and military spending, which then put the money back into the economy.
Okay, how important is it to have some kind of monetary reform candidate then? Because that, unless you're going to change the way that the government deals with money, having it kind of arm's length, farming it out to the banking system to provide this money for them, rather than, you know, taking the
ball
by the
horns. One of the interesting things that's going to happen is the Federal Reserve going to raise interest rates? Now, in actual fact, Trump probably believes that they should raise interest rates.
But they're private bankers, aren't they?
They will crash the system.
The point being, they're private bankers. They're not the US Treasury, are they? And the US Treasury should be, if you're in a democratic country, running the money system, sure.
Well, the Federal Reserve is a semi-private organisation, as you've rightly pointed out. And Donald Trump, I mean, what's interesting is the French National Front possibly going to be big contenders next year in France. And these right-wingers are not necessarily free marketeers anymore. But at the same time, I didn't hear a single word from Trump about raising taxes on the rich. And it used to be 96% was the top rate of tax. And he hasn't, and he's not telling his financial backers that he's going to do that. That's what he needs to tell them.
I remember a few months ago you talking about an article by William Engdahl where he looks at, actually, that Trump has mafia connections, some quite strong ones.
Yeah, his father was if you think about Trump, he made his money building casinos in Las Vegas and Atlantic City. And you can imagine that he ran into a few characters there who were let's put it this way, they weren't your standard mainstream business people.
And I'll put a link to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, folks, if you want to look into Trump's mafia roots, which
both candidates have got had massively questionable relationships with semi-criminal organisations in Wall Street and elsewhere.
It does seem it's more about PR, but anyway, let's have a look at the Labour Party's reaction to it, because Labour's Yvette Cooper was on BBC Question Time last night, and she had this to say about the election of Donald Trump.
The problem is, we have no idea how Donald Trump in the end is going to behave with Putin. And to me, it feels like this could go in either way. And that's why I do think, particularly around NATO, we have to work with the US government and we have to hold them into NATO and seeing NATO as being particularly important. My worry is that in the relationship, that if Donald Trump signals that somehow America is less committed to NATO, that less worried about Putin's belligerence, that will somehow tempt Putin to take action, whether it be around the Baltic States, whether it be around Ukraine, whether it be in other areas, and we will end up actually in a very difficult situation where NATO commitments will need to be honoured, but that actually Trump has given licence to Putin to do dangerous things. And the second area I'm worried about is that he will get drawn into somehow supporting Assad in Syria, because if we end up licensing what the Assad regime is doing, we will never get peace in Syria and we will never get a settlement in the Middle East.
Right. That was Labour's Yvette Cooper speaking on BBC Question Time last night. Tom, there, she's talking about the threat of possibly leaving NATO. You know, this is a little bit worrying, surely.
Well, I mean, NATO was set up under the Cold War in order to really be a bloc against the Soviet Union. It's quite different from the situation now. And I think, actually, if you look at what's come out of the Obama regime, there's already been a bit of a shift in focus from Eastern Europe, to a certain extent from the Middle East, towards the kind of Pacific region, and really keeping an eye on the rise of China as a world power. So I think, you know, partly what Trump is putting across is a bit of that, really. But it's not fully within his control. I mean, Richard Nixon, when he came in, said that he was going to kind of draw down from the Vietnam War. That was partly the basis on which he won. And he ended up overseeing an escalation of that war. So, I mean, certainly these things take on a logic of their own. And if it looks like American interests were being hit somewhere, he would come under enormous pressure to respond to that.
Martin, is Donald Trump going to pull out of NATO unless all the Europeans pay much more to be part of it? He sees it almost like a kind of protection thing. You know, you pay us the money and we'll protect you.
Yeah, and I think it's pretty appalling. I was very unhappy with what
protection racket
said.
Maybe.
Well, I mean, in actual fact, NATO has passed its sell-by date. We shouldn't be going on about NATO. NATO is actually a threat to world peace. And NATO, of course, as we cover frequently on this programme, has got a track record of supporting terrorist organisations, from Al-Qaeda to the Red Brigades to various other groups that they've supported over the years. And most people don't really understand that, but that's what NATO does. It is a protection racket. Now, what's really fascinating to me about Yvette Cooper is that she was one of the Labour MPs that voted not to cut off arms sales to Saudi Arabia because of their continuing bloodbath in Yemen. So at the same time as going on about how Putin's a terrible guy for supporting Assad, who was actually elected 2 years ago, he overwhelmingly won the election in Syria. They haven't recognised the election, but the NATO internal reports, which have been leaked, say that Assad's support on the ground in Syria is about 70% of the population, and they certainly control the vast majority of the population. And of course, Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, was on the record as saying that he was approached by British officials before the Arab Spring, we are going to start an armed uprising in Syria. So the British started the war in Syria. Yvette Cooper, frankly, is completely off the wall with her remarks. And I'm a member of her party, and I note that she voted to carry on supplying Saudi Arabia with weaponry, and we will take necessary action against them.
Okay, finally, what about Trump on TTIP? Because that's quite interesting. He's talking about completely pulling out of it.
Yep. That's right.
Why? And it may,
why? Because in many ways, these so-called free trade agreements are agreements not to trade with other people. And proper free marketeers understand that. And it'd be interesting to see what the Tory position on this is going to be if America, if Clinton had won, push for TTIP. Because by signing up to TTIP, you're signing up for all EU regulations plus US regulations. So that leaving the EU then becomes a pointless exercise.
Tom, apparently the last in the world to admit that Trump was the winner Tuesday night was the BBC. They were still saying, oh, Hillary's in with a chance after everybody else.
Well, I stayed up till about 4:30 watching it, and for about the last hour of that, it became increasingly apparent that the presenters were coming up with more and more desperate mathematical ways in which, you know, if she wins this state, then she can take it. I think, you know, a lot of people from the establishment obviously wanted Hillary over Donald Trump. I think a lot of ordinary people this side of the Atlantic also quite rightly feared what Trump was doing and would be quite shocked and upset about this as a result.
Well, former Army officer, intelligence officer, police officer Charles Shoebridge was tweeting, well, the poor old mainstream media, they were lamenting the fact that their supremacy in determining elections, Martin, and narratives is a thing of the past. It's now social media that's doing a lot of this.
Maybe so, but as Tom pointed out earlier, Hillary Clinton actually got more votes, and the American system isn't a democratic system, and that's why we're not really bound to recognise the results. And in many parts of the world, people just say, well, we don't care who runs the US, we don't recognise this as a democratic setup. Putin, on the other hand, got 80% of the votes at the last election.
Also, honestly, as a part of a reaction to this yesterday, the Chief Rabbi Ephraim Mervis appeared on BBC 5 Live, where he's a little bit worried about the Trump election, and he's also calling anti-Zionism the new anti-Semitism. So let's have a listen to that on the Emma Barnett show yesterday.
There are worrying trends throughout Europe and in the UK as well. Recently I gave testimony to the Home Affairs Select Committee, and when they wanted to quiz me on anti-Semitism, the very first thing I did was to take out a sheet of paper and I drew a large dot in the middle. And I said to the panel, what do you see? They thought I was a bit crazy. And then I explained that most people would reply, oh, we see a dot. But actually, a better answer is we see a blank sheet of paper. And on that blank sheet of paper, there is a dot. The blank sheet of paper represents the state of the Jews in Britain today. Things are great for Jews in Britain today. We have a very warm and welcoming society. However, there is a dot which is getting larger, and that's anti-Semitism. We do need to be concerned about it, and we do need to be vigilant.
Why do you think, though, it's getting bigger, that dot?
We're finding that there are new forms of anti-Semitism, whereas previously anti-Semitism predominantly came from far-right groups. Today, it's also coming from the far left. We're also finding that there is a phenomenon of what some call the new anti-Semitism, and that is that anti-Zionism really is a cloak for anti-Semitism. It all depends if one is critical of Israel for genuine reasons, such as citizens of Israel within Israel, that is fine. But if one understands that Zionism means the right of the Jewish people to have their own homeland within secure borders, then anti-Zionism effectively is anti-Semitism. So we're finding that increasing. But I must stress that broadly speaking, we're benefiting as Jews immensely from living in this country.
Well, I mean, the point there that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, that's just fundamentally wrong. Zionism is a political movement. It's there's no onus on anybody necessarily to support Zionism. The Jews have got no more right to an independent state or less right than anybody else. Kosovo is not independent, as recognised by Spain. Crimea has not been recognised as independent from Ukraine by Western countries. Israel is not fulfilling its obligations under international law to withdraw inside its boundaries of 1948, which means giving up the West Bank. And if they don't do that, then it's perfectly legitimate to say, well, we're not going to recognise your state.
This chap Ephraim is actually the leader of Orthodox Jews in Britain. Who are you to say?
Well, he can say what he likes, and I can say what I like. I do not accept that opposition to Zionism is anti-Semitism. Just as I don't accept that opposition to Crimea's independence from Ukraine means that people are Russophobic.
Well, so why is he saying that then?
Well, he's saying it because he wants that. Because he supports Zionism, he wants people who are opposed to Zionism to be labelled as anti-Semitic. That's what he wants to happen. But I don't accept that.
Are there other Orthodox Jews out there that would disagree with him?
There are other Orthodox Jews who don't accept the existence of the State of Israel, and they actually oppose the existence of the State of Israel.
So
in other words, he's actually not even there. Are as we've had them on the reported on the show before. There are some Orthodox Jews who think that the State of Israel is a blasphemy.
In a way, when he says he's the leader of all Britain's Orthodox Jews, that's a lie.
Well, he's a leader of some of them, and he's entitled to his views.
Okay, well,
but
let's
his
have
views
listen
about
now.
Anti-Semitism and Zionism, I don't accept.
He went on to talk about the Ken Livingstone suspension and the anti-Semitism in the Labour Party.
The Home Affairs Select Committee unanimously, within their cross-party group, identified the fact that within Labour there is insufficient action being shown by the leadership. We're still waiting for implementation of some of the aspects of the Chakrabarty report, and we're still waiting to see genuine evidence that the Labour Party leadership is taking anti-Semitism seriously. A serious number of members of the party were suspended. So far, nothing's been happening. All types of world events have been taking place. This is still on the boil. It is still a very serious matter, and we would like to see the issue being dealt with very effectively.
Why do you think it's not been? I mean, 6 months is a serious amount of time.
I really don't know. We're just concerned.
Have you spoken to Mr. Corbyn lately?
We have engaged in various conversations from our community, and don't forget that the Jewish community has a very strong connection with the Labour Party. Historically, great support for the Labour Party, wonderful Jewish members of the party. And don't forget as well that the problem of anti-Semitism within the world of politics exists probably in all parties. It's just that within the Labour Party currently, it is not being tackled sufficiently, and we're waiting to see what the leadership is going to be doing. And unfortunately, we're waiting and waiting.
Do you think that Ken Livingstone should be banned permanently from the Labour Party? He has only been suspended after he made those remarks about Adolf Hitler and Zionism.
The Labour Party will hopefully be implementing the recommendations of the Chakrabarty report. I'll be surprised if he won't be expelled on the basis of what they have written about what the considerations that they will be taking into mind will be.
And do you think he should be, though?
I think he should.
You think he should? Because from what you said there, you talked a little bit, and this is another question I wanted to come on to. You talked about different forms of anti-Semitism and the way it can be cloaked in anti-Zionism. How do you feel as the leader of the British Orthodox Jewish community when you are asked to defend or comment on Israel's foreign policy?
I'm a faith leader. So I'm the head of the Jewish faith here in the UK. And when it comes to the policies of governments, that happens to be political. Sometimes political issues are faith issues as well. I'm a passionate Zionist. I'm a supporter of the State of Israel, but I'm not the ambassador of the State of Israel. And clearly, I'm proud of Israel's record in so many different respects. But at the same time, my role is to be the head of the Jewish faith here in the UK.
He thinks that Ken Livingstone should be expelled from the Labour Party, Martin.
Well, I don't agree with him. He's entitled to his view, and I'm entitled to mine. The State of Israel, if it doesn't behave according to international law, should be de-recognised from the United Nations.
This is about Kevin Livingstone saying that Hitler supported Zionism, and he said that 6 months ago.
All that Livingstone pointed out was an absolutely factual matter, which was that the Zionists did cooperate with the Nazis about the idea of sending Jewish people to Palestine, and they even sent a joint delegation to Palestine to scope it out. That's a fact.
Difficult to argue with, but I still don't quite understand why the leader of all the Orthodox Jews in Britain should be saying that actually the Labour Party should expel Ken Livingstone just for simply reporting something which is a historical fact. There seems to be a battle over history here.
There is a battle over history, and I would say, is the rabbi a member of the Labour Party? Because if he is, then he's got some say in what the Labour Party should or shouldn't do. But if he isn't, then basically he's got to leave it to those of us who are.
And it's time now for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to our guest, Tom Baldwin from Trade Union and Socialist Coalition. After the news, British journalist Vanessa Bealey.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.